Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2023. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imslan. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. Great. Nice to hear your voice and get back on the saddle and start telling more stories here.
Super. Sounds great. Scott, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Scott, you and I were talking about some of the other experiences you had, and one was back in the early 70s, your days with ARTA, A-R-T-A, with another guy named Alan Wilson. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. Alan was leading this trip. And we were on our snout rigs, and we probably had 20-some people on it. And we had four or five boats. And we were doing the carbon chew-ar hike around, which means that somebody will walk all that were capable of walking up the canyon and down the canyon and back to the boats. A guide would take those people, and then we would also, at the same time, bring boats down at chew-ar, leaving the hiking up to Carbon and then down to Chur. And at some point...
So Scott, can I jump in here and make sure I understand this? So
sure.
this is a hike that starts at the mouth of Carbon Canyon and
mm-hmm.
goes west through the
mm-hmm.
Butte Fault
mm-hmm.
and then south to the
mm-hmm.
next drainage south, Lava Chur Canyon, and then you walk down that canyon back to the river, and that's as far as the water's concerned, it might be just less than a mile or so. So the walkers walk, and then the boats, they've left the boats, and they're going to rejoin the river downstream of where the boats were.
Mm-hmm.
So the boats have to be floated down by other guides.
Yeah.
To where the passengers and the guides that are walking with the passengers are going to show up.
That's correct.
Just so I understand, kind of. But, so I've got
I got to shut this off. Sorry.
Okay.
My compressor just kicked off.
Oh my gosh! I was like,
"Oh
wow,
God,
what was that?"
Shook me out of my chair. I don't know. We can delete that somehow. But
before we get going into this story, I got to ask you. Today, that walk is a highway.
Oh, really?
In the early 70s, what was that hike like? I mean, there's some scrambling to be done in there, and once you get out of Carbon, then you got to go over this hill and down into Chur.
That's correct.
What was the path? What was the trail like?
The trail, as in many of the places at that time, were very slight. And there were times like, you know, I could, you know, exit finally Carbon and you'd look around and go, and it was so raw that you go, oh, let me think now. It looks like the trail must go over here. But if we go to the right, we're going to end up getting away from the river. So it was kind of like it wasn't really well defined by any means. It was a little bit of dead reckoning, but people were doing the trip through there now, so it wasn't like completely unknown, but like many of the trails, then when people found out North Canyon or they found out other canyons, that all of a sudden people were hiking up Saddle Canyon,
right?
None of those things had trails at all. There's lots of trailing all over the hillside. Nanquip was another one, multiple trails everywhere.
Okay.
And that's the way it was sort of in Carbon. It wasn't much traffic yet, and so they were slight trails, and they were sort of recognizable, but they were by no means a highway at all. It was
right.
A very pleasant time to do it because it hadn't been torn apart yet.
And how did you hear about this loop? Do you know who kind of was early
you know,
in to figure that out?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I do not know. But like I've said earlier, with the various guides coming off of trips, there were those that were really inquisitive about, wow, I wonder if that canyon hooks up with that canyon. Or,
mm-hmm.
geez,
mm-hmm.
That would be a great place. And looking at maybe the geologic map or a more modern map of Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
He went, God, I bet you we could get to this and go to there.
Okay.
Well, that was all dead reckoning and just going, God, we should explore that. We'll next trip, let's pull over and we'll make sure we do a hike through there. And take people up and say, oh, that was a dead end, but that was fun. We found out.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Off we go.
All right. Sorry, I interrupted. So let's get back to the story here.
Okay. So we're talking about Alan Wilson and the trip with the older passengers on it. And
was that sold as a geriatrics trip, or was it just
that
a bunch of older people were on the trip?
No, that happened all the time. I mean,
okay.
I had some really old people that I just was, you know, it's just, how did you guys make it through the office to get put on these trips?
No.
You know, but that was all about probably just, there was some money to be made. Yes, you can make it, you know. I think there was a marketing scheme of, you know, 8 to 80 or something like something was like, we take people blah, blah, blah. And I got a lot of old people that went down, and I'm really happy that we got them down safe.
Yeah.
We shook up some of them, but, you know, they were game enough to do it. And,
cool.
And I personally just looked out for them and took care of them as good as I could possibly. And everybody made it from top to bottom, and nobody died, drowned, broke a leg, or anything like that. And
good deal.
That was pretty neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this particular trip had a few of those, and somehow up at Carbon, I believe is where a boat either somehow wasn't tied up properly or somebody mistakenly untied it, and it drifted out of, maybe we have four boats maximum, five snouts on this trip with 20 people, 20-ish people. And somehow that boat got untied and started to drift away down towards where we were at Chuar Canyon and Chuar Rapid. And one of these older people and his wife decided that shouldn't happen. We're losing a boat. We're going to go save it. And they untied another boat and hopped in, never rowing. But, they were old and they weren't thinking as squarely as they should have. But now, not only was the boat going that was untied, but now he untied a boat and hopped in. And so now we were down to just two or three boats left. And life jackets were on the older couple's boat and life jackets on the boat that was cut loose and was floating down the river. So we didn't have many life jackets. And so when Alan came to me up the canyon, up to our canyon, and says, we've got problems, I went down, and here we've got two boats left on shore and boats that have gone downstream with gear, food, commissary, everything, and we're looking at each other. We don't have enough life jackets to put on people now. And we got to put everybody on the last two boats.
Hang on. Let me make sure I understand this. By the time you got your overlanders, the walking people, to the river, Alan comes running up and says,
"That's right.
We're missing boats."
Yeah.
And so there's a rapid just below the mouth of Lava Chuar formed by the side canyon. That's a meaty little rapid. And so the older couple is downstream with their commandeered boat trying to go after the ghost boat.
Right.
Okay.
Has
Alan sent any of his crew down to get them? or are they all still huddled up, hold up tight, waiting for you and your overlanders?
No, we're all getting everybody down at the beach.
Okay.
At Chuar. We're all the hikers and me, we're all together. Alan has ran up to me and told me what is happening. And we kind of trotted and told the people, you know, let's move along or whatever. And so we got back to the beach and learned more about what was going on, what the situation was, how dramatic the situation was, how devastating the situation was. We had more people than we had boats. We didn't have enough life jackets. So it was one of those you know, on the Titanic, where women and children get the life jackets, and the men, you're on your own, be safe, whatever. But that's how lean it was, with the boat, two or three boats gone. I'm not sure exactly, but I know the old people had a boat, and the other boat that was set adrift, and then we had two boats up at Chuar. So that's probably close to how many were going on. And so Alan and I are talking, and we're trying to figure out the safest thing to do with not enough life jackets. We've got Hans, Tanner, Rapids right out, and Chuar, having to get off the beach and run Chuar safely. And it turned out that we split the people up, and I got half the people, and Alan got half the people on his boat, and the life jackets went to the women, and we just packed half of the people on my boat and half of the people on Alan's boat. And the decision to go after the old couple and that boat, and to try and find the boat that was cut loose, we weighed all that information, and we go, you know, if we don't find them before Hans, you know, they're going to die in Hans, and we've got to get these people down. We don't have radios to say, hey, send a motor rig, park service, or do something to help us out here. So in the situation, we decided, we split up the people. I got half, Alan took half, and we headed downstream, and we didn't realize how heavy the boats were now with all these people. And
so not only did you have half the passengers, but you had another one of the guides that was out of a boat that was missing a boat, and Alan would have had one of the other guides that was missing
true.
A boat.
True.
So there's like the entire trip, less two people. So we're talking about 18, nine people on a rowing snout. No,
I was trying to figure out what you figured out, and I always thought I was roughly in the 10, 11 people on my boat.
So if it's 20 passengers and four crew, that makes sense. So now you're dealing with 12 people. No, 10 people, sorry.
You got
11 people, sorry. 22, yeah, 11 people. Hey.
Yeah, huh. It was just, and in another one of the interviews, I had mentioned how doing that single boat trip, until I pushed off of Lee's Ferry, I didn't realize how heavy a seven-person trip plus all the gear for a month down there.
Right.
I didn't realize when we pushed off with all these people how low that boat ran in the water.
Mm.
So that affected the rowing. And you'd ask a question about how long the oars were or how high they sit off the boats. But when we pushed off with the people and told everybody what we're up to, what we've decided to do, and this is what we're going into. So, you know, in a sense, hang on, you know, we're going to try and get to those boats before anything happens. And we've got a situation that we've got to deal with right now.
And so let me think about this now. There's a design. The boat rides so high in the water, and the oars come up at an angle that the boatman sits on a seat and grabs these oars with his hands. As the boat goes down in the water with more load, the oar grips come down into where the boatman is sitting. I mean, that's a lot, but towards your knees anyway, towards your thighs.
They're into the lap of your body.
Wow.
Oar handles are down in the lap of your body.
Wow.
And think about what that blade's doing out there, and how you can work that boat sunk so deep, and, you know, being able to get a purchase with your oar and the blade.
Wow.
Those were things that you would never, who would think of that? Nobody thought of that as we pushed off.
Right.
And God, I can hardly row. This thing is so heavy. I can hardly row this thing. And we're strong, of course, by this time in our life.
Yeah.
So we headed on down, and we're going through what I just talked about, but shortly it's like, whatever, we've got to deal with the present, not what we're our obstacles with our boats and our rowing right now. We've got to do everything with absolute safety and an eye out for these rafts that are floating freely down there with the old couple and on its own boat. And so towards the end of the story now, we had everybody watching, everybody in the two boats watching for the two boats that were free downstream. And luckily, we saw a boat on the right-hand side stopped in an eddy. And then as we got closer, we could tell it was the old couple. And then as we got even closer, we could see that the boat that had gotten loose from the shore, its stern line, no anchor, the stern line was dangling off the stern of the boat. And the stern line, as if God's hand seriously was guiding this whole experience for all these 20-some people to get them out of it safely. I truly, it had to be in God's hand, mm-hmm. because that errant boat that floated off the beach, it had snagged the stern line in a rock in an eddy and had stopped itself.
Wow.
And the old couple had seen that, but weren't strong enough or capable enough to understand. But their boat naturally went across the eddy fence and sat there with the free boat that had come
down. Oh, my gosh.
So we had both boats, the old couple, and we got the errant on its own boat all in the same moment. And it was like, talk about relief and praise the Lord, thank you. And it was all done just above, I believe, Tanarap, and that all happened, that it was, we got those boats. And it was really super exhilarating to know that we didn't have to go through Hants. We were wondering, what the hell are we going to do when we get to Hants? You know, we've got all these people. I think we're going to decide, if we can't get to Hants, we're going to hike somebody out on the Hants Trail and deal with it at that point.
That's Scott,
the only thing we can think of. Yeah.
Can you tell me more about Alan Wilson? Where was he from, and what was he like? What do you remember about him?
Alan Wilson is from Oregon, and he is a longtime historic boatman for Arda Azra, and he also was a part of Arda's attempt at running boats on Niagara Falls, below Niagara Falls.
Okay.
He was a very varied, experienced, capable, sorted out perfectly boatman. I've done a lot of private trips with Pete Wynn and Alan. He was a part of like the group that did these private trips, specifically guys that were a part of the kind of the old run of the boatmen.
Okay.
And Alan, he was raised in Oregon and was very mechanical, could fix anything, enjoyed doing that. I think he helped design those snout rigs that we ran. He was just a great guy. He's still alive and still active and so forth. So Alan did many trips with me. He did many Grand Canyon trips. And, yeah, couldn't have had a better person. He and Pete Wynn and I would have been the trio to figure out these impossible situations. And that was one of them. That was.
Did you meet Alan when you first went to Oregon as a young man? Right out of Sacramento?
No, I don't believe that was when I met Alan. I did Middle Fork private trips with Alan. I did Selway trips, private trips with Alan and Peter, Rob Elliott. So he was probably just mixed in to all the private stuff that we did. And then when I came to Grand Canyon, Alan had already... and was already there, so
okay.
He was capable. And he ran motor rigs for Arda, too. So he was a motor rig guy, and then when motor rigs switched over to oar-powered in Arda anyway, in Azra, that's where he moved over into the rowing boats. But he was a good oarsman no matter what. But
okay.
He did a lot of time with motor trips. So
Cool. Okay.
And that was Alan. Yeah. So to end that story, it's pretty much done. And we were thankful that we got everybody on the boat. And we had a big party that night. And yeah, that was, you know, a lot of critical things can happen when you're running a river trip in Grand Canyon. And this, again, gets back to being an all-around kind of person to be a guide and boatman down there, from fixing motors down there when you have nothing, doing what you can when all your spare oars are broken and you've done this or that. You know, there's a lot of stuff to being a guide down there, and you never know what that's going to be until you're in the situation and you're going, wow, you know, what are we going to do with this?
And occasionally boats get away. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, definitely. There's no doubt about that. And for me, this will go along with the Ledges Camp story. But to me, it was like you can't learn enough down there. And when people have talked about losing their boats and so forth, man, one rule I had was never touch those stern lines that are tied off at night in the dark. Do not mess with your boat when it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
And leave them wherever they were left in the daylight. Don't go, oh, you know, maybe that wasn't good enough. You know, I should untie them, blah, blah, blah. Never touch them after you've set it all up. And then also run lines between every single boat. And,
right.
And that will give you some insurance. And these kind of things weren't right away known until you're down there a lot. And like with Alan's story of that boat getting loose, somebody monkeyed around thinking, oh, I got to undo this because I'm going to get that one ready to go down. And well, they undo the wrong one, and that boat's now drifting away, and there's no way you're going to grab that boat and pull it in.
Right.
But
right.
Anyway, yeah, it's a lot to learn in Grand Canyon or just in boating in general. And that was, it went from don't undo any boats at nighttime, run a line between all your boats, you know, whenever at dinner time or whenever you feel like it, usually mm-hmm. when we park mm-hmm. and so forth. And just be mindful of everything around that can happen. Where you anchor your boats, you know, in the eddy, what they're going to jam into, what they're going to get torn in the middle of the night. And then when you wake up in the morning, you find your rock is up in the air on a big boulder in Olo Canyon campsite, or, you know, at the Ledges Camp where I was. That was one of the stories of the water dropping and nobody thinking with the all high water we came in on that we weren't really thinking of what was going to happen. But
oh, so what's that story? What's the Ledges story?
That's what the Ledges story is about, is, again, you can't learn enough down there and you can't do enough trips to make sure you're a competent guide that can cover situations and be anticipatory on situations. And so here, a snout rig came in and we parked. And somehow it was tightened up. I don't know if it was during the night or whatever happened. But
so hang on. You're on a river trip, and
mm-hmm.
and you've got a bunch of people, and they're in the Rowan Snouts. And Ledges is a camp above Havasu,
mm-hmm.
and it has ledges. It has kind of limestone ledges that go right into the water, and the water gets deep right there. I mean, like really deep. So you sort of pull the shore, you step off the boat, you're in camp, and you have these ledges, and you need to tie the boats up to the shore.
True.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's a good camp because it's close to Havasu, so it's a really desirable camp.
Right. Got it.
And there's a little bit of a waterfall there.
Oh, right. That's right. There's a little trickling waterfall there. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty spot.
It's a nice spot. It's a dramatic spot. You're on rocks. You're not on any sand. You're looking across the river at this fantastically tall wall. And then when it rains, it's a drag because the little pour-overs and stuff start going to people's tents. So you'll get woke up. Joe and Mary, you got to move. You can't be there right in line of a flood here.
A little water course, yeah.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Then there are times at Ledges Camp where rocks were coming off of the far wall as you're looking, you know, from your camp. All you see is this huge wall, and there were, we could hear the bam, 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 and kersplash, and we're going, oh, Christ, we're getting rocks as well as a bad storm here at night, mm-hmm. and we're having the rock falls,
yeah.
which ledges could have the same thing I'm watching across the river with these guys crashing down the walls. And nothing ever happened, but Ledges is a very interesting camp. It's a dramatic camp again, and it's a quiet camp. There's no sand. You're hanging out either on the boats or up in your campsite and maybe take a little walk up somewhere. But this gets back to the snout rig, I think, getting pulled up because maybe somebody didn't want it banging around in the eddy. Somebody made some decision for that. I don't know.
Okay.
And then we get up in the morning, the water has severely dropped out from what we came in on, and the boat was just hanging by its toenails on the cliff there.
Wow.
And way out of the air. And the stern line was as taut as a violin string. It was just like the whole boat and all the gear was hanging off of that rope up tied up on a rock. And we had to figure out, so how do we do this? Do we cut the stern line? We can't untie the knots. They're so tight from the weight. And it's hanging.
Huh.
It's hanging on a cliff. Not in the water, not touching the water.
Right.
It's hanging vertical.
So even if you cut the rope, it's gonna drop some feet into the river.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So I believe at some point either the rope was cut or it was untangled at some point, so it was balancing on its own on one of the ledges, and somehow it got tapped lightly to see kind of like structurally how supported is this thing right now and what's going to happen. And so with that light, delicate tap, the boat flipped, not end for end, but side to side, onto its belly. And so all the gear was in there, crashed down the ledges and so forth. Maybe some gear, a boatman that was coming to train, an Idaho boatman, Jerry, I can't think of his name right now. Jerry, not Jordan. Anyway, he'd come down in his brand new boots that he'd gotten because Idaho used boots a lot and so forth. Mm. They came out of the boat and into the water and they were gone.
Oh.
He was sad. Jody Kelly, that's his name. Jody Kelly was my Idaho friend that we rode all of our Middle Fork, all the flooding trips with and so forth. But he came down to train. And so he had all his gear and it was all open and he wasn't familiar with the Grand Canyon. And when that boat flipped, he lost all his gear and we probably lost some commissary stuff and whatever. But anyway, that was a boat hung up on ledges and flipping. And it was mainly because the boat wasn't placed in the right spot. And it wasn't, the right spot would have been to have stretched line out and supported it in the eddy there, not bumping against any cliff walls or anything, but making sure if the water dropped, the boat was tied in like 4 points so that it would stay in a certain area.
And Scott, this would have been in the days when the dam was releasing huge amount of water in the afternoon at the dam, and then at night they would turn that all off, and then the next day they would turn it all on again.
So very true.
So you could get a big swing of many thousands of cubic feet a second of water.
Absolutely.
Between the daytime and the nighttime. Was that area near Havasu an area where you expected the water to drop out at night?
You know, that's a good point. And in the, let's call it the earlier days, yeah, there were tremendous exchanges of flows down there, and you could get up in the morning and you go, whoa, water came up, and your boats would be kind of banging around a little bit in an eddy or whatever, or they were swimming around and the river was going super fast, faster than yesterday had been when you were floating. And ledges, I think we were aware of that, and I don't know the situation that caused that boat to be so taut and pulled up so high.
Okay.
I don't know But that's what happened. And that was just somebody's naive mistake.
Yeah, the water drops out at Stone Creek, and there's a giant beach there, and you had to kind of keep those boats floating in the middle of the night. You had to get up, you had to move them down, because otherwise they would. You have to really work hard to get them back to the river. And that's not too terribly far upstream from ledges, so it kind of makes sense that that whole area would be dropping at night. And when there's a big drop from the dam, that could hurt you.
Oh, God, yes.
Huh, yeah. Okay.
There were many, like South Canyon, it was another place where it's a big, huge sandy beach with a huge, huge, slow eddy that had a lot of sand. So when the water dropped, your boat was several yards out to sea, sitting on a sand island.
Right.
Because just for what you're talking about, you come in at one water level, and if you're not smart enough to start pulling them in when you had water or letting them go.
Nobody wakes up at night and sleeps right through it. The boat settles in on the sand. You wake up in the morning and you're out here, you know, 20 feet from the water's edge and go, okay, well, I'm not going to get my feet wet when I get out of the boat.
Yeah, really. And you got to gather, hopefully you have enough people when you have a heavy boat to be able to pull that thing, you know,
spin it around back to the water. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not an easy thing. Those are big mistakes that the more you were down there, you weren't going to forget.
Right.
It's going to take 25 people to push a snout into the water. So you're very mindful of certain problems down there the more you do it. Yeah, so anyway.
Do you have any other stories of that early 70s period?
Let me look at my little list here.
I think there's...
See, passengers...
Didn't you find something above the Little Colorado River back in the early 70s?
Yeah, let's go to there. That's finding the pot. And we were floating down, and it was a slow drift down to Little Colorado. And I had, again, some older people in the boat, and we're all just kind of watching the walls go by, a lot of Tapete sandstone at that point, a lot of ledges. You know, you could, Tapete was a great rock layer to, like, ladder up. It had lots of nice, easy ways to get up and over and on top of hilltops and so forth. You come to Tapete's sandstone, you had a good way up a canyon wall or something.
Okay.
Anyway, with all those kind of ledges due to Tapete's, we were floating along, and a lady says, that's interesting. Look at that. And I look over at the wall as we're going by. We're going by really slowly because it's slow water. And we're just putting along, and I look at that, and I go, wow. I said, I don't know. And being in the geology department, I was really knew about concretions, and also concretions are in Grand Canyon and various limestones or mudstones or whatever down there. So concretions, you know, that looks like a concretion. I've never seen it in Tapete's, but yeah, that looks like a concretion. And I didn't think too much about it, but we continued on with the trip, and I told somebody on the boatman on the trip, I said, you know, we saw this concretion up there, and it was a nice round, like basketball kind of thing. And then I got to thinking, I wonder if that was a pot. And again, this is like, that's the wildest thing. I mean, that's crazy. And, you know, it was kind of high up on the wall. And it, how could it have managed pre-dam to have existed with floods like you can see on the sides of the canyon walls where the floods can go to.
Right.
And so we ended the trip, and that was fine. And then the next trip down, I said to some folks, my brother happened to be on that trip, and I said, you know, when we get down to this spot above Little Colorado, I'm going to pull over. Typically, at a certain time of day, there was a sandbar right there, so it would have been easy. It was easy to pull over and tie off. And so I got out of my boat. My brother and I got out, and we walked and scrambled up the hillside and up onto the Tapete's. And another boatman friend was coming by, and I said, where is that round pot or that? Where is this round pot, maybe a bowl or something? And he goes, yeah, it's just below you. And you couldn't see, of course. I'm up on cliffs, and I couldn't see what was going on. So he says, yeah, it's right below you. And I go, okay. And so I stair-stepped down the Tapetes and got to the ledge that it was on, and they probably said, yeah, it's on that ledge. Just keep going along that ledge. And so I went along the ledge, and lo and behold, it was a fully intact Anasazi pot.
Wow.
That was like as big as a basketball with a rim on it, and it was upside down tucked inside the Tapetes ledges there, untouched. And I took pictures of it and looked all around to make sure there was some way that it could be extracted. And when the trip was over and we talked about what could have been under that pot, it was upside down, intact, perfect condition. And it was so fun to like dream about what could be under that pot.
Mm.
And it hadn't been touched. It had a little, the lip of that pot had crusted probably salts and dirt and so forth. So it hadn't been touched since it was placed there. And so it was really fun. And then I went back to M&A and talked to Bill Leip, who was the archaeology, head of archaeology at M&A. And I probably talked to Bill Breed too. Yeah, I talked to Bill Breed about it. And so we got a helicopter to fly. See, the next trip, we found the pot. And the next trip, we got the helicopter with the archaeologist, and we flew in.
Was that Park helicopter, or was that an M&A chartered helicopter?
It was, I think it was the Park's helicopter, but it would have been very easy to M&A to work through the Park, or mm-hmm. the Park, you know, it was cordial in that respect. In fact, M&A got to keep that pot
okay.
for many, many, many months. And then finally the Park says, okay, we're going to take it. So now it's in their library, their storage area.
Cool.
But anyway, so, and following with this, a very interesting moment for me, we got the okay to get the helicopter. So we flew, I drove up to Grand Canyon and with Bill Leip and so forth. And we got in the helicopter. And I told him where we needed to go, above Little Colorado and so forth. And I said, there'll be a sandbar. At this time, there'll be a sandbar that we can land at the chopper on, and we can all get out and go and get it. And in getting in the helicopter, now I've spent many trips down there, but I had never been anywhere but on the river to be on my river trips.
Okay.
So when we flew up on the helicopter, we took off, and we immediately... We got up in the air and flew right off the ledge of South Rim mm. and descended down into the canyon. And I was flabbergasted at what the canyon really looked like.
Oh,
I'd
wow.
never seen the canyon. I didn't know what it was other than these tall walls and a river. And it was like really mind expanding to have been with so much time and so many trips down there, isolated in some respects. Then we got in the helicopter and I got to see what it really looked out. Now, I didn't know there was even practically a North Rim. I didn't know there was a North Rim that people could go to or take hikes down and so forth. I could see that. Then we flew by where the planes had crashed and went down on that cliff. I can't recollect the name of that cliff that they crashed into.
But, yeah, that Crash Canyon, and then Chuar Butte up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1956. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went over that and took some footage of that because we had heard, I knew that there was wreckage up there, but the park had said we could never, even though we could camp below there, we could never go to it, of which I honored, and mm-hmm. everybody on my trips we honored. We never went up there.
Mm-hmm.
Other groups, other companies, I don't think they, it was like, oh yeah, you know, we should go up there, check this out. And there's some parts you can find of the plane and all this. Well, I never did anything like that. And, so it was neat to see where the pocket was, what the planes landed in. And, that was right on our way. That's right across pretty much from Little Colorado and
yeah.
very near where the pot was.
Okay.
So we went right over that, and then we landed and got out, and Bill Leif and I walked over to it, and he lifted it up carefully from its setting, and dust kind of came out of it, tinkled out of it, and he looked at it, and it was all in one piece. There was not like a bunch of shards. It was all intact, and he said, yeah, this is, I believe he said something to the effect that it's probably 10,000 years old or something. It's of such and such era by these, not Navajos probably, but whoever lived around there at the time. But he had some information on it and blah, blah, blah. And we took it back to Grand Canyon or back to M&A. We got it in our storage. And then the park wanted it back, and they got it. So now it rests in the archives of the Grand Canyon Library.
And was that a grayware utility pot with the little thumbnail prints kind of all the way around it, or was it a painted pot? Do you remember?
It was not painted, and it was strips that were pinched together, as I recollect, to make the bowl. And there was a lip that flanged out, I believe, on the top.
Nice.
But no painting whatsoever.
Okay.
And
rough exterior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But symmetrical.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Nice.
You can imagine them, the ladies or whoever, twisting the clay and laying it one on top of the other, pinching it down, and so forth. That's kind of how I recollect it. Remember it.
Cool.
That pot.
And then smoothed out on the inside.
Yeah, and under my name at the library there, and in the archives, my name, and finally, after I went there a few times and they didn't know where it was, and I kind of got on them that the information was given to you on this date, blah, 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 and you've lost it now. We're going to find it, and we're going to catalog it, and this is who found it. My contact information, this is years back now, but so now the last time my kids went and they ran a January trip in Grand Canyon, and I said, when you're there, and I called the lady that ran all that stuff, the archives, I said, I'm Scott Imsland, and I've got a pot in your hands there, and my sons are coming to run a January trip there, and I'd like for them to be able to get in and see the pot.
Cool.
And she says, oh, absolutely, no problem. And your name is such and such. She says, yeah, we got the pot, and it's over here on this shelf, and it's cataloged, and there won't be, and I told her a little bit about what I told you. It's like, you guys didn't even care when it came to you guys. You didn't even know where it was. Mm-hmm. I had to go in there and go through all the collection to say, that's the pot right there, and this is whoever put on a little card this information. But after that, after I talked about it, and then I called up for their January trip, and they said, oh yeah, on your name right here, and it's still here.
Cool.
Or it's here. So if anybody on this recording, or you, anyone wants to go and see that pot with my name, Scott Imsland, you'll find it.
I'll ask about it. I'd like to see it. It'd be fun to take a picture of it and connect it up to this interview. That'd be fun.
Huh. Yeah, that's absolutely
very cool.
Yeah, that's so that takes me through personal experiences.
You know, I think the next thing you had told me about was something that happened not long after that, in the sort of mid-70s, maybe 73, 74, soon after you started working for the Museum of Northern Arizona on their river trips, a couple low water trips that you did in the 73, 74 area, kind of January sort of time. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. It was on our first January trip, of which hadn't been done since Colb, maybe, or whoever else did something in the 20s, an inventory of Grand Canyon. So a January trip hadn't been done in many, many decades. And so we needed to go down and see what it was like down there in January, which was cold, icy cold. Like my sons, like I had mentioned, had just gone down last year or year before in January. And it was like summer, not quite that good. But they said, oh, everything you told us, it was pretty warm down there, actually. And I go, well, I've done it only in March and January where it was absolutely icy, cold.
It can be freezing, really cold.
Really bitter cold.
Yeah, below freezing.
No sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything is frozen, you know. And so anyway, so that January trip was cold, definitely cold. And let's see, we didn't notice or know of what the flows were to be. We probably were given some idea that there's not much electricity for Las Vegas and Phoenix and California at that time, so we might have low flows. Somebody might have told us that. The park and us, with M&A and these trips and the grant money, we were pretty close to the park in asking for or getting whatever we wanted, which was kind of a comfortable situation to be in, that we had so much support, either air flights or helicopter flights or them doing stuff for us.
Nice.
And so we're going down, and we hadn't noticed anything extraordinary about our levels, really. And then we came around to UNCAR, and I think before we came to UNCAR, you might recollect better than I, but I think that's somebody's name, Rapid. Who's that? The name of that rapid? It's somebody, an old-timer's name.
Tanner?
No, it's it would be below Tanner.
Basalt? Neville's?
I don't know that.
Yep, 75-mile Neville's Rapid. That's just above. Well, no, that's below UNCAR. And you're above UNCAR, right?
We're above. Before National and all that, if I'm right about National being up in that area.
No, National's going to be way down below Havasu, but
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's below Tanner, but anyway, the rapid that we had done before we got to UNCAR and Sauk and all that, I think that's where we got a heads up on how rocky it was, and that there were either old timers that got hung up in that particular rapid, but we got there and I go, there's not much water here. I've never seen
so the water was dropping out under you as you were approaching the UNCAR area.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we're going along, and we get to UNCAR, and UNCAR has some rocks in it on the right side as well, and really low water. And so we got through that, and I think I went kind of far right, I think is what I did on that, whatever was reading water at the moment. And that was fine. But then there's a rock bar below UNCAR that's just a little riffle normally. I think there's some Indian ruins above that little rapid.
Yeah.
And so that whole bar was out, and with rocks, not sharp rocks, but just all full of rocks. And I couldn't get, there wasn't a path through it. So I got out of the boat there and lined it up and pushed it and lined it up and pushed it. And it was so shallow that I was able to like walk and push the boat. And I got through that, and still never expecting that Sauk Dowager would have a similar effect. And so we went down and I got to Sauk.
Or Hance. I mean, you Hance would be the next one. But you'd have to go through Neville's or 75 mile to get to Hance. But let me go back to UNCAR for a minute. UNCAR is this kind of rapid, goes around a curve, and then the bar and the other rapid near the Indian ruin is all at the bottom of this. When you got out, were you wearing mud boots or concrete boots, or were you just tennis shoes? What were you wearing?
I was probably just in tennis shoes, saving anything else for. I don't think I would have had rubber boots. I mean, that would have been senseless because the tops would have filled up with water. Whoever expected to be walking a boat through Grand Canyon? I did that in Idaho, but not here in Grand Canyon.
Yeah, but it's January and that water is blisteringly cold.
Oh, it was fucking cold. Yeah, it was cold. But it was, doable. That's the only way I could get it down.
Okay.
So I just hopped over and pushed it. Yeah, you're right. I'm thinking the next piece of the story would have been down now to Hance.
Okay.
And hence, we pulled over on the right-hand side, and it was a sunny day when there was sunshine there.
Oh, good.
And that, for me, people kind of laugh. Oh, you had sunshine. Oh, that's a big deal. But it always was to me, whether it was floods in Idaho, Selway, Grand Canyon, a wrap boat in Grand Canyon, a flip boat in Grand Canyon. If it was sunny, my spirits were a lot better than if it was raining.
Seriously. Yeah. That's normal, sure.
Yeah, that's... And so we got down to Hants, and I looked at it, and we walked it, and you could have... It was so low that you could have practically walked across Hants. That's how little water was left.
Wow.
It was the lowest water I've ever seen. And you could have practically walked across. You could have certainly walked across some of it. And so we had to figure out how we were going to run it with our big old snout rigs, two snout rigs, Steve Crothers and I.
Okay.
And Pete Wynn was also on this trip. Pete Wynn and I and Steve Crothers and then just the regular M&A people. And there was... Peter was good to have on the trip because he was like Alan Wilson, a solid guide, solid boatman, made courageous decisions at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
And here we were at Hants, and it was so low that all the boulders that were holes probably or rapids in normal water, the rocks were everywhere. And we had to stuff our snout rigs in between. And it turned out I didn't really want to run it. We were in early midday, sunny, and we would have been able to gotten our boats across back to the other side if we really needed to. But I kind of disagreed with Peter that we should go for it, you know. But Peter said, no, we can do this. We can do it. And I go, if we screw up and leave a boat out in the center of this thing, I mean, it's full of rocks. Not pushable a boat in hand. We had to get the right slot to get down. I said, that's a big risk. We could lose the boat. We could lose a boat or both boats out there in the middle of this thing.
Right.
And I don't agree. I think we should go back to the other side camp and wait for water to come up. This would be the history of however the highs and lows were at that time. Maybe we were on just a super low and the high was going to be coming back tomorrow.
Yeah.
I said, it's worth it. We just hang on the other side and see what happens. It's pretty risky to push off here.
Mm.
And Peter didn't agree with that. And he said, we should run it. We should just do it. And so I went along with what Peter thought would work. And I looked at it and studied it more and I could see a channel. From all the Idaho rowing, which is all rock dodging and falls and all that, it's a great, if you want to become a boatman, go to Idaho and learn how to row.
Yeah.
And when we, and here I was looking at this and going, God, this is back in Idaho again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no mistakes to be made. I got to figure the run out and hold on to the run. And so I pushed off. I was the first boat. And, I made it through, and out of all of my rowing experience in Grand Canyon, that was absolutely the most testing experience ever for rowing in Grand Canyon. It was so close to what it was like in the mountain flooding rivers where no mistakes are possible, big water, a lot of stress. And when I got done with that rapid, I had pivoted that snout rig so many times using boulders to like touch the bow to swing it one way and then recover from that and maybe do this and that on a snout rig. It's got two tubes so you could split a rock that was coming. You could split the boat between the tubes and the rock. So it was a kind of a break to have two tubes on a boat. And I used that. Going over rocks, not hitting the floors as we went over them.
Cool.
Not hanging up the tubes, spinning the boat when necessary to line up for the next drop.
Okay.
And anyway, the whole thing was a bunch of ricochets down successfully. And I was keen on no mistakes. So there's nothing about an accident that got me down through. It was all the pivots, lining up and doing the drop. The final drop was near shore with two big boulders that could fit the width of that snout rig.
Huh.
And I placed the boat right between the two boulders near the shore, and it dropped down like off of a cliff. It went clunk, clunk, clunk. And then I was next to shore, and everything was really slow because there wasn't much volume water. So everything was slow after I made the drops down through the boulders. Then they grabbed me in the boat, tied me off, got me out of the way because Carruthers had to come through. And Carruthers came through, and he did pretty good. He got it to the point where I'm talking about the drop between the big boulders next to shore. He didn't make that. He got hung up on those boulders. And so luckily we had enough strength and position to pull that snout rig up and over and past all that and get it to shore. So that was the only thing with Hans. It was just so challenging, and the only thing was Steve got hung up at the very end, and it wasn't out in the middle of it all, so that was
right.
Good. He made it almost there. And Steve, in a lot of respects, was still learning, and a lot of testing was done on him on these winter trips and these off-season trips as somebody that was really kind of learning the whole thing still. So, but he did good. He learned a lot, and he became a successful boatman on our crew.
Yeah.
And so after Hans, it comes down to Sock. And Sock was so low, like up at Uncar, that I had to hop out and line it up, push it through channels, get out, push it through more channels. So I pushed two-thirds of that rapid. I basically pushed and lined up my boat.
Wow.
And not getting it hung up on any boulders or whatever. So that was back in the water again, lining up and pushing and hopping on the rear tubes when it would float, making sure it didn't leave me with the crew
right
in front of me. And so I was mindful of that, but going into some big hole that I wasn't aware of, of course. But anyway, Sock was so low that I had to push it through Sock. And then one thing that was really, really that nobody will know unless they've gone at super, super low water, is after Hans and before Sock are some Vishnu Shiv spires that are under the water. And after Hans, there are some boils that occur below Hans Rapid. And those boils, I always kind of wondered, I wonder what's making all that. Well, it turns out when the water was that low, there are schist spires that are polished, knife-edged spires that were just like statues or an artist had placed them there. They were so gorgeous. And it's kind of a center left side at low water. And if you want to go up to Hans's Mine and all that, it's kind of across from where you'd pull in that eddy there on the right if you want to walk up, if they do that anymore, go up to the asbestos mine. But anyway, that was really beautiful to see these spires. I think there was some whip that we could go in between some of them in some point there. But if you're ever down there and somebody can get it at that super 1700s or 1500s, they'll get to see those spires that are underwater.
And then where did the water come back up by the time you got the Phantom?
It must have, because as we got close to Clear Creek, it was low still, as we're still floating down from all the other adventures. We had to pause and stall to figure out how we were going to get through this one rapid above Clear Creek.
83 and a half mile. Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And you know of that, huh?
It drops. It's a little ledge at low water. It just drops off. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do there?
So when we were there, somebody mentioned, or I had heard, that rapid was, in their ancient mind of the ancient times of rowing down there, that was the only rapid outside of M&A now, but I think it's probably a mixed up conversation with all this in it, but they said that rapid is the only rapid that blocked getting down at certain water levels. That's the only one that you could not get around out of all the rapids.
Huh,
that rapid, you can't get through. Well, we had enough water, But it was just like you're saying, to look at that, we had to stop and go, well, this is crazy. Out of all the trips in Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. here was a spot that's a nothing rapid, and it's going to be impassable. And but we got through after negotiating where we should put the boats and so forth. We got through it. But that was real pretty stunning to come upon that with some lore about it. And yeah, I saw it, and I go, yeah, I can see that, you know, not getting through here.
Yeah.
So that puts us down at Clear Creek, and you're saying the water ever came up. We might have gone and camped down at Grapevine, maybe, but I don't think, I don't recollect harsh conditions after what I've talked about on the following days. There wasn't like ever big water.
Yeah, if you pulled into camp, then somewhere in that area, then the water would have come up, and next day you would have been good to go again. So.
Yeah, that's how I remember. I do remember, I don't think it was a January trip. I think it was a different one. But the wind was howling so hard and raining so hard upstream at Grapevine that we had to stay for quite a long time before we risked going our boats back into the water and doing that rapid. And we got stalled. There was so much wind, our boats hung at the very top ledges over those pour-overs.
Wow.
And you couldn't row against the power of the wind to get the boat downstream. So it was like you're hanging on a cliff that won't let you drop, and it won't let you drop, and we can't drop, and we're getting blown back upstream, and we've got to get our boats in a channel to get through this rapid. We're just hung at the top. So we finally, I don't know if that was January, but that was in that area that we probably would have camped in January. And running that rapid was horrible. Okay, go ahead, whatever question you have.
That's good. I think this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series right here.
Yeah, okay.
With these recollections you've got going up through the mid-70s, the early mid-70s. Mm-hmm. For the timeline, that piece sounds great. Does that sound like a good idea?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's we've talked or I've talked endlessly, so it's
that's good.
I brought out everything step by step for the various situations, and you've got a little list of other stuff that I can talk about next time.
I do.
And
okay,
and you can take sounds it from good. There. And
with that, let's conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and you brought me again back many years to some wonderful experiences that are still warm in my heart and in my mind. I can still recollect the situation, and with the talks to you, you make me sweat and be frightened again from those situations that I had to just figure out and solve.
Cool. Hang on a second.